Many of you may know that in the end of September of this year, the FBI carried out coordinated raids on the homes of political activists in Minnesota and Chicago. Many of the people who were targeted were affiliated with a group called Freedom Road Socialist Organization. It's been around a long time and very active in anti-war and solidarity activity. The FBI entered the homes of these people. They took their computers, their cell phones, their books, their literature, their private papers. And as well as these raids, they also served 14 people with grand jury subpoenas. Later on in December, 9 additional people were served with grand jury subpoenas. And the people who were targeted in December were people who were active in solidarity work about in the Middle East on behalf of the Palestinian people. Some were Palestinians, others were North American people who had traveled to the Middle East as part of delegations. So we had a situation where 23 people were under subpoena from the grand jury. Now, you may know that the grand jury originally, historically, was supposed to stand as a buffer between the government and the person accused. It was supposed to decide whether there was sufficient evidence to charge somebody with a crime, and it was made up of citizens, and the citizens would act as a check on government overreaching political persecution by the government. But and it comes from the common law and from England. And as a result, it was put into our Constitution that no one could be charged with a felony or a capital offense without an indictment from a grand jury. A grand jury is made up of 23 citizens who are similar to a small jury that hears cases. They're taken from the jury rolls. But the grand jury has never operated in that way. It's always operated in a way to protect the government, to deal with the people, the political people who are in power. And after World War II, and particularly in the 60s and 70s, the power of the grand jury was taken over by the FBI and the U.S. attorney. And instead of acting as a buffer between the citizens and the government, it became an investigative arm of the government. And what happens is that if you're called before a grand jury, you can be asked questions about your political views, your associations, what literature you read, who you are involved with, what meetings you go to. And once you begin to answer questions in the grand jury, you cannot stop answering questions. And what also happens is that you can refuse to answer questions before the grand jury by asserting what's called your Fifth Amendment rights not to incriminate yourself. But the government can take away that Fifth Amendment right by giving you what's called jus immunity, which means that what you say in the grand jury, your words cannot be used against you, but they can still charge you with crime. And once they give you that jus immunity, you either have to testify or you go to jail for contempt. There's two types of contempt. There's civil contempt, which means you go to jail for the life of the grand jury, which is up to 18 months. Or there's what's called criminal contempt, which is a crime which can be punished up to life imprisonment. There is no specific limit on how much time you can be given for criminal contempt. I represented a Palestinian man who refused to testify about his movement before a grand jury. First in New York, he went to jail for civil contempt. He came out after 6 months. And then he was subpoenaed again to a grand jury in Chicago, basically investigating the same thing, the funding of Palestinian resistance groups. He refused to testify again. He says, I'm not going to be an informant against my people. I don't know where this information is going to go. I think it's going to go to Israel, and I don't trust that. I have family there. He refused to testify again. And this time he got charged with criminal contempt along with other charges. He was acquitted of all the other charges, but the only issue whether you're held in contempt or not basically is if you testified or not. So he didn't testify. He was convicted of criminal contempt, and he was sentenced to 11 years in prison. And he's now doing 11 years in prison in a federal prison in Virginia. So the power of the grand jury and the usurpation of it by the FBI and the government is a powerful tool to investigate political movements. And it's been used historically against the Black Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Women's Movement, the anti-war movement. At one time in the late 60s, early 70s, there were 80 grand juries and over 100 people were under subpoena to testify. And one very famous case of a woman by the name of Leslie Bacon, who was an anti-war activist, the question they asked her is, tell us every meeting you went to in 1970, who was present at that meeting, what was discussed at that meeting, what you said at that meeting, and what other people said at that meeting. And those are legitimate questions for the grand jury. So what is this grand jury now about that's targeted these people from Minnesota and Chicago who are involved in solidarity work? Essentially, and we learned this from the search warrants that we saw and the grand jury subpoenas, they are claiming that these people who are under subpoena and whose houses were searched were involved in providing what's called material support for a foreign terrorist organization. Now, in 1996, under President Clinton, a law was passed which made it a crime punishable then 10 years, now 15 years, to provide what's called material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. And what the government gives them the power to do, this statute, is the Secretary of State can designate foreign organizations as terrorist organizations, and you can predict what organizations are going to be on that list. Of the five main Palestinian organizations, four of them are on that list of designated terrorist organizations. Organizations that are involved in Colombia, in the Philippines, in Nepal, any organization who's opposing U.S. foreign policy in a militant way are designated as a foreign terrorist organization. There are now, I think, 60 and 75 organizations on that list. Once the Secretary of State designates an organization on that list, you cannot challenge that. It's done in secret. You cannot be heard on it, and obviously, if you come forward and say you're a member of that organization, you're liable to be prosecuted anyway. So the process of designating an organization is done pretty much what we call in the law ex parte, one-sided, and it's done pretty much in secret. And once an organization is on that list, if you provide what the statute calls material support for that organization, then you are liable to be put in prison for up to 15 years. Now, for many years, 96 is when the statute passed, the question was, what is material support? Obviously, if you provide guns and safe houses and weapons for an organization, that's clearly material support. But the government has continually expanded that definition of material support to include what now has been considered First Amendment advocacy. And in June of this last year, there was a case in front of the Supreme Court called Holder, which is the name of our present Attorney General, versus the Humanitarian Law Project. And in that case, there were some professors and human rights activists who wanted to give counseling to members of the Tamil Tigers, which don't exist anymore, and for the group in the Kurdish group, the PKK. And they wanted to counsel them about how they could bring human rights claims before the United Nations. They wanted to train them to do that, and they also wanted to train them how to begin peace negotiations around their struggles in their particular parts of the country. They were just basically providing information and training to them about how to obtain a peaceful resolution to their struggles. In the lower court, and this is important to understand, in the lower court, The court said that to provide counseling about peace and human rights was First Amendment protected activity, and it couldn't be material support, and if you criminalized that, it would be a violation of the First Amendment. And then, unfortunately, that opinion, which was favorable to those people, was appealed by the Obama administration. And that's why the name of the case is Holder, because it was brought by the Obama administration. And essentially what the court said in that case was that it doesn't matter if you're providing First Amendment advocacy for these groups. If the group is on the list and in any way you are coordinating or working with that group, either under their direction or in any way coordinating with them, regardless of whether it's First Amendment activity, you're violating the law and you can be prosecuted for it. So what happens now is the law has been expanded to go after First Amendment advocacy work on behalf of groups. And these people whose homes were raided, and many of them who are subpoenaed to the grand jury, are accused of providing material support by supporting in advocacy means the PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, and the FARC, which is a group in Colombia. And basically what the government is doing is building a case to charge them with material support for these groups because they're on the list as designated terrorists. And we are predicting and expecting indictments against the leaders and other people who are members of this group, as well as members of the Palestinian community in Chicago and other places, who have been educating people about what's going on in the Middle East, and obviously talking about people who are involved in resistance against the occupation. So we've moved to a stage now where First Amendment advocacy is now criminal. And this is the Obama administration that's pushing this, which is consistent with what they've done in other areas of civil liberties and civil rights. It's not Bush light, it's Bush continued and expanded. And I can go down a list, but I'm told I have only 2 minutes left to talk, but I could tell you that the Obama administration now is institutionalizing the civil rights attacks that Bush initiated. And because the Democrats don't want to speak out against Obama, we have like now a bipartisan support for all these things that Bush initiated and Obama has expanded. So we're hoping that there's been a lot of support that's generated for the people under subpoena. So far, no one has been forced to either testify or go to jail yet. 23 people are in limbo, waiting to see what the government's going to do. We expect indictments in the next few months. 500 people demonstrated at the courthouse a couple of weeks ago. There's been demonstrations other places in the country. And this is a serious expansion of repression against political activists, solidarity work, and it's going to create a chilling effect on people across this country, because the U.S. government does not want people to talk the truth about what's going on in the Middle East. They just vetoed the only vote in the Security Council, 15-1. They vetoed a resolution condemning the settlements. The U.S. government is in with the Israelis, as you probably all know and agree, and they don't want people talking about the real issues in the Middle East, and they're trying to silence people who are doing that. Thank you.